Tony, your two musical families here in London and in Rome are a wonderful sort of snapshot, if you like, of your mixed heritage and give you the best of both worlds in some ways. But we're here today to talk about your Italian family and to some of the recordings you've been making for EMI with the chorus and orchestra of the Accademia Nazionale di Santa Cecilia, and including the very exciting live recording of Rossini's operatic Swan Song, William Tell. But let's talk a little bit about the character of this chorus and orchestra. Heard to stunning effect, I think, on that recent recording of Rossini's Stabat Mater, which I think is just sensational. I was trying to think of a way of describing the chorus, a phrase that might sum them up, and I came up with this idea about churchily theatrical. How would you characterise them? Is that a reasonable assessment?
Well, it's very interesting because voice for voice, that chorus, they are all operatic potential. So you say to yourself, well, it's not possible, even from personality point of view, it's not possible that they can come together and become a homogenous group of singers. Mm. And I still don't understand it to this day.
It's a kind of collective intensity, isn't
yes, it?
It's like all these beings coalescing.
But they're very disciplined. That's what's amazing. In other words, sometimes I even have to ask them to, come on, let it rip a little bit, you know, because they always remain within a certain framework of good taste and best word is dignity, I think, you know. And I love that. It's a wonderful instrument, therefore, to work with.
I suppose that's what I was getting at when I used the church image alongside the theatrical image. Yeah. And I suppose the Rossini Stabat Mater has that quality. I mean, it's a really heady brew and full of surprises, things that you might not expect.
Well, I think if you talk about any Italian religious choral work, you get into the same discussion, don't you? I mean, it's endless discussion of whether this is it sounds like music for the theatre. But you know, I think the heart and sentiment, an Italian heart and Italian sentiment, and elements of fear and need or consolation makes up for it kind of makes a soup that is contradictory somehow.
Yes, well, that's the fun of it, really.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful because a religion and religion therefore is an extreme. It's emotive. It's not as contemplative as with other cultures.
It's not sanctimonious.
It's a cultural thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Now, you and the orchestra have also been making waves in repertoire one wouldn't automatically associate with Italians or Italy. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised how idiomatic your Mahler was with them when I came to hear you do Mahler's First Symphony. But I've also been very struck by your recording of Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, which is a piece that when I was growing up, it was rarely, rarely performed, and when it was performed, it was butchered. And it's a glorious work, I think. And again, a vocal quality to the melodic writing. I mean, the string playing in your recording is terrific. I mean, how would you characterise the orchestral sound?
Well, the shaping of phrases I've found to be something very wonderful, because in Italy, where the ideas or the natural what we call rubato, give and take of phrases. Mm. We share the same instincts, and so I don't, in many ways, I don't have to rehearse those kind of things which somehow together we share naturally. My musicians in the orchestra, not all of them have played a lot of opera, but some of them are very young, and for some of them it's their first job. But opera is inside every Italian musician. You can't help it. This the idea that you learn an instrument, because you learn, you have to learn to sing with that instrument. That it's the necessity to sing, and I think you sense that now. What I found myself having to work on was sustaining, because the Italian string culture is based on a certain amount of virtuosity, lightness, grace, and for the big German things, you know, you just the sustaining of tone to make phrases longer and more thought through, you know, binding up so that we create a longer span of attention for the audience. But they've cottoned on to that, because with that they've seen their sound grow. When I came to the orchestra 5-6 years ago, I found an orchestra that was very well trained. Myung Wong Chung was my predecessor, and in a very difficult hall where they were before the present hall, they did some terrific work. I mean, to make the sound beautiful and but I felt that the personality of the orchestra was closed. It was all careful and timid and not what I would call Italian.
Yes,
so
yes,
I've felt that through a certain amount of technical work and encouragement to be what they are, all of a sudden the orchestra is soaring, because they're free to make the music that is I know is locked inside them. When it comes to something like Rachmaninoff, I mean, Rachmaninoff, the Russian language is very similar to the Italian language in the way it phrases. It phrases over the bar line. It's not a vertical language. It's a phrases tend to go to the end of the phrase. You know, it does, and so you have direction and you have a sweetness of tone, and you know, you just have to listen to Rachmaninoff play the piano to know.
Yes.
You know, and the tunes are the tunes. So that the feeling of sensuality. Is very, very strong.
I'm thinking of that drop-dead gorgeous second theme in the scherzo of
yes.
the symphony, which is, I mean, what about the portamento in that? I mean, it's implied so strongly.
Yeah, but, it's overdone in often. You're talking about...
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, if it's done all the time and at every opportunity, it's vulgar. But I think if it's introduced here and there, it really is ravishing.
So, William Tell, and life before the Lone Ranger. I mean, it was the last of his operas. He was 38 when he wrote it, which is extraordinarily young, and that was the end, effectively. But it's remarkable, is it not, for the way it breaks new ground for him. And I'm puzzled. Apart from its great length and certain difficulties in the tenor part, and I'm puzzled as to why it's never done. Why do you think this is?
Well, I do think it's a potential nightmare for any scenic designer and stage director. It's so much chorus to handle, so many groups of chorus, and that creates issues of expense. You need a big enough chorus to be able to divide that chorus into many parts, like an act two, the men, the three different squadrons of Swiss patriots. But I think it's difficult to find singers who have the kind of panache to deliver this work. And we all know about the legendarily difficult tenor part, but the soprano part, if you include the aria from Act Three, which was for over 100 years was always deleted. I mean, it was never done. The role became something more elegiac, something more wan. But my God, the fire in this character, if you include that aria. Now, that's a lot said. That aria is so unexpected. Ferociously difficult roulades, extended high notes, delicate bel canto, and the coloratura that's in it, or the fioritura, the embellishment, comes after you sing this very, very dramatic lead. It's often the other way around. And then so it's a big challenge. The opera is not done, I think, because it's very expensive to put on, but I think the challenges of sustaining the drama are difficult. You know, with all the operas that were written for Paris, you have these interruptions. You have interruptions for dance. You have numbers for entertainment. And in a way, a sort of a Shakespearean idea that tragedy or theatre must have contrast for the conflict to be potent. It's only in relation to the divertissement that is on the other side. But of course, this becomes such a overblown state of affairs in all Parisian operas. Look at Don Carlo, a huge ballet. Look at Vespri of Verdi. I mean, and you know, the Meyerbeer pieces and all that. It's problematic. Do you do the ballet? Do you not do the ballet? So I understand the problems. I can tell you that we have plans to do it in 2015 in London. So I'm really very happy about that. We're going to give it a go. Yeah, wow. I mean, it was done here in 1990, I think. I remember. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, you know? It is a long time. What do you think stands it apart from the other Rossini?
Well, I think Semiramide, for instance, is a very grand affair, and it has all the pomp and majesty and maturity, but William Tell has a nerve in it. If you somehow can see through the thread of these dances and the thread of it and the finales and the orchestral writing is so tense and so full of verve and unexpected life in the recitatives, in the what we call, you know, the what is like spoken dialogue, yes. What brings the story forward. Yeah. These are very well crafted, and I think they spurn the action on. They prepare the numbers in a fantastic way, but I think behind everything is this greater idea of liberty, this social political idea, which is bigger than just a love triangle, if you like, you know. There's that too. There's the Austrian princess, the Swiss warrior, and duty and family and all those things that we know and love in opera. But the idea of liberty and freedom and what that makes Rossini do. And when you listen to the finale, that is something new. There's hardly any music there. There's dum da 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 dum da 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 dum da da da.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And yet this thing builds to such an enormous vision of a utopian idea of contentment and happiness in the world.
Thank you.
there's a spatial effect to it all as well. I mean, the evocation of nature in the piece. Yeah.
I mean, the pictorial elements are extraordinary, very new.
Yeah.
Creating the sense of space on stage, things in the distance, wonderful.
Yes, and of course it's in French. And the fit, I mean, is extraordinary. For a man who kind of breathed the Italian language, I think that's remarkable too.
Well, I think the Italian composers that wrote for Paris reinvented themselves to a certain degree when they wrote in French. Mm. A lot of the writing of Don Carlos, especially in the first version, and Vespri, and William Tell, the composers are not writing so much in an Italian idiom, if you look at it carefully, and there's this added, somehow, nerve to the language, and finesse, of course, to the orchestral effects. There was a feeling, I guess, from the composers that they were being judged in a different way. They had to up their game, but in a certain department. Fluidity, transparency, virtuosic effects, all of which appear in all the pieces that I've talked about. But of course, Schiller, you deal with Schiller, you deal with epic length. Mm-hmm. And Paris was used to length with Meyerbeer, but the slow telling of a story, the patient telling of a story, or this turning of the screw carefully and slowly with interruptions, is something that's not easy to make a case for today in theatre.
Well, he's such a great playwright, I think.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing quite like Italian chorus and orchestra in this music. You talked about panache, but the choruses here have tremendous panache and fizz to them, and it's wonderful to hear the Italian audience responding to the manner born. They won't be as loud as the prom audience.
The prom audience
are going to be... They're going to lap it up, but that is excitement. There are many standout numbers in it, honey, and I don't know which your favourite parts are. I think the trio in Act Two.
Trio in Act Two is extraordinary. One of the great numbers. Also, I mean, I've talked a lot in different times about Rossini's influence on Verdi, but you listen to that trio and the vocal writing for the tenor. It's undeniably something that Verdi cottoned onto. The declamatory, repetitive reiterations on a single note. Ta, 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 you know, this kind of thing, which becomes something of a time of 20 years later, you know.
The tenor role you've already talked about, its notorious difficulties. You found this American tenor, John Osborne.
Mm.
But it's not just about the virtuosity and the high notes. It's that last act aria where it's high and soft.
Yeah.
I mean, that extended passage, he sings it so beautifully. But I mean, that's where the real virtuosity comes in.
And so late in the evening too, you know.
Yeah.
After the role is very... is treacherous because of the length of certain numbers, the duet with William Tell, the duet with the soprano, the trio, the whole finale of Act Two makes huge demands on the tenor. But as you said, to then spin this magical line and then have the guns for the cabaletta, which finishes this gallop that is the music.
Thank you.
he achieved something very, very special, and everybody knew it. There were no patch sessions for this recording. It was just taken from three performances, and he just achieved something really special. He did it every night, but on that last performance, he was just sort of in a state of grace, as we say.
It's often said that Rossini's life was, the term that's used is a swift triumph and a long seclusion. Was it just that he had achieved so much? I mean, he was the most famous operatic composer, probably of all time.
There were other reasons why he stopped composing opera. Had to do with some political and financial reasons. He left Paris. The idea was to always restart at some point, and he never got to it. And I'm not the greatest scholar in the world, so I won't bore you with my lack of precise knowledge. But the idea was not to give up. I've created a masterpiece. That's it for me. That's rubbish. That's ridiculous. Mm. But it worked out that way, and I find that very fascinating, and that he continues his musical life as a sort of father figure, sort of Delphic oracle somehow to go to visit, to, you know, and then, you know, his this surprising decision to make religious choral music, you know, Stabat Mater and the Petite Messe Solennelle, which I think very much furthered his art, in certainly in terms of orchestral colouring and precision of expression. The thing is with Italian music is that you have to somehow dig behind the words and look for clues everywhere. Sometimes in the most simple gestures, and that is richly repaid when you do that with Rossini. And there's, I think that's why I work like the Stabat Mater is really, really something important, because the little touches that are all over that are from a maturity that we can't even begin to fathom, you know, even for such a young man. And he wasn't so young when he wrote that, but for such a short career,
yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, he was larger than life in every way.
But he liked the good life.
Life, and he was probably, I mean, the fever of having written all those operas one after another. I mean, there was almost no hiatus, you know. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, that, I don't know how long you can do that for. And so maybe there was a sense of total exhaustion. But the lift of these pieces and the charm and the sparkle, I mean, he must have been something.